The Tom Woods Show, episode 1040.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, it's that time of year again. This holiday, give Harry's and give handsome. Get your holiday shopping done early and take advantage of free shipping. To get a limited edition holiday shave set while supplies last, go to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Big thank you to you good folks out there I see sharing the episodes of the show on social media. I really, really appreciate that. Anything you can do to help me spread the word about the show would be appreciated. Let's keep growing the audience the best we can, and your recommendation holds a lot of weight with your friends. So tell them about it, how much you get out of it, how much you enjoy it. I would really appreciate that. I'm doing what I can to promote it, but let's see how big we can get this audience, and I'd really, really appreciate your help if you could do that. Send out an email to a couple of friends. Hey, why aren't you listening to this? Here's a great episode. Well, of course, if you want to have a great episode, an important ingredient is Michael Malice, who is joining us once again today. Michael, you know by now, is a celebrity ghostwriter, very successful one, author in his own right of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. You can check him out at michaelmalice.com. He also has his own program over at compoundmedia.com called You're Welcome with Michael Malice. That is one provocative program that I myself enjoy very much. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
I don't remember when the last time was, but for some reason it always seems too long to me. I want to talk about one of your Observer columns that I'm linking to on the show notes page, not alongside any ebook, on its own at tomwoods.com/1040. It's called In Western World, Fragmentation is the New Normal. And let me let you summarize what the gist of it is, because I think this is good food for thought here.
So one of the things we always get asked, you and I and many other people, is, are things getting better or things getting worse? And a lot of times people just have a visceral reaction, and things are certainly complicated. So there's much evidence on both sides to answer that question. And things are getting better in some ways and things are getting worse in other ways. And I think one of the things that as Americans we tend to do is we tend to understandably focus on American politics and not pay much attention to politics in other countries. We'll pay attention to what other countries are doing, you know, the Chinese president, maybe Brexit, things like that. But in terms of actual elections, that's something that most of us don't have the background or information to be able to study and process. And that's, I am one of those people. I am not extremely well informed on, you know, politics in other countries, but I have been, you know, carefully watching the parliamentary elections in the last year or two in many European countries. And to me, this is the best evidence that things are getting better, both in terms of practical applications of freedom, such as technology and, let's say, off the top of my head, Bitcoin, but also in terms of limiting the power of various governments.
Well, in particular, in your piece, you point out that although in all kinds of other aspects of life, we see what we might call fragmentation or a wide variety of possible experiences, it's only in politics where we're still stuck in a binary mode. We're still stuck in the 50s, just like we have three television channels again. We have two political parties. We have two ways of looking at the world. But the rest of our lives, and not only the rest of our non-political lives, but even the political lives of much of the Western world, is undergoing a seismic shift in the sense that we now have many, many different options. And instead of what we had for a long time, which was at least the facade of agreement. I mean, like in the 50s, yeah, you had Eisenhower versus Adlai Stevenson.
Or even the 80s. Even the 80s and during George W. Bush, we had consensus about the Iraq War and then consensus against the Iraq War. We had consensus about TARP. It was a wrong consensus, but there was a consensus.
Yeah, that's true. I think the consensus was even more complete in the 50s, because then there were certain topics people didn't discuss. Now, today there are topics they don't discuss, but I don't know. I think there's something kind of different. So anyway, the point is that today, all of a sudden, we don't even have the veneer of civility that we used to have about, well, you know, I disagree with so and so, but I respect him because of X, Y, or Z. It really is, it's me versus the devil, a lot of folks think.
Well, you make a couple of interesting points. First of all, there's a great book by Jerome J.D. Tuchilli, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, called It Usually Starts with Ayn Rand, or Usually Begins with Ayn Rand. And he says, and you're going to pardon my French, I'm going to censor it for the family-friendly audience, what Ayn Rand did with Atlas Shrugged, what Atlas Shrugged is, she said, F you to Dwight Eisenhower. That's how he puts it. And his point is there was this consensus, this very pro-government consensus, and she came in and said, all these things that everyone has agreed upon are not only things I disagree with, but are wrong and evil. So that's, you know, one major point. The other point I would make is I often have arguments with friends of mine who are, you know, conservatives or on the left or something like that, or even, you know, libertarians, and they bemoan the lack of civility. And I look at it in the same way as you look at, you know, let's suppose you have a family with an alcoholic father, right? And he comes home and he's violent, physically violent, verbally abusive, and all these things. And it's precisely this veneer of civility that the family keeps this a secret that allows him to get away with this and doesn't force him to get help. And the same way in politics, if you pretend, you know, oh, Tom, you're for war, I'm against war, let's discuss this in the same way we're discussing, you know, splitting a check at a restaurant. This veneer of civility that, like, oh, it's a civilized thing to go murder people overseas, or it's a civilized thing to put people in jail because they want to smoke a plant. It's very useful mechanism for the state to further its oppression over the population. So I'm very much in favor, and I'm sure you are, even though you are much more polite than I am and much more, you know, reserved and well-mannered, you certainly do not think that these people in Washington should be treated with any sort of civility and respect because they are monsters.
Yeah, I mean, and that is, by the way, the Hans Hoppe advice. He says these people should be laughed at and ridiculed constantly, not welcomed and have a red carpet rolled out for them at your event.
They should have a red carpet rolled around them.
Yeah, there you go. Indeed, indeed. Now, the thing is, most of your piece for The Observer had to do with the way politics is fragmenting around the world, and there is the rise of different parties, or there are more extreme views than we've seen in the past. In the U.S., that doesn't seem to be as much the case. We still have the Democrats and the Republicans, even in this extremely polarized world where Democrat and Republican can't possibly encompass the diversity of differences that Americans have, yet we're still wedded to that. So we're not really seeing this replicated in American politics, or are we?
Well, we are and we aren't. So let me break it down a little bit. You know, and this is very basic. This is politics 101. In Europe, I think the vast majority of European countries, they have a parliamentary system, right? So sometimes it's two houses, but usually it's one parliament, one house. And whoever becomes the leader of the majority party overwhelmingly becomes prime minister. So and he picks, or she picks, different members to be his cabinet. So effectively, it's as if the House of Representatives in America were the entirety of the government, and therefore Paul Ryan would be our head of state. And he would pick, you know, the different chairmen and chairwomen of the congressional committees. Those would be his cabinet. So it's a different system than our own. However, we could talk about that in one second, but let's talk about how that works in America. Yes, we have two parties, but these two parties have many sub-parties within them that really don't have that much in common. For example, you have the Rick Santorum wing of the Republican Party, and you have the Rudy Giuliani wing of the Republican Party, and Ron Paul was in the Republican Party and Rand. And yes, the three of them might have some small overlaps in terms of a Venn diagram, but the idea that they're effectively partisans in the same sense and of the same party is a little bit inaccurate because—
And that's not to mention Trump.
I mean, of course. I mean, so if you looked at that Republican primary, you had the— I mean, maybe it wasn't 17 parties represented because many of those politicians agreed completely on most of the issues, but there were certainly extreme and very real subdivisions in the primaries. And we're seeing it now because even though the Republicans have a 52-seat majority in the Senate and a fairly significant majority in the House, they are not able to get a majority vote on anything that matters other than getting the Supreme Court approved.
The Republicans, it's true, it's fun and interesting to break them down and see who's who, because for a long time they managed to marry competing strains of thought, and largely because of the Cold War, they were able to come to an agreement that we're anti-communist, and you have your reasons being anti-communist, we have our reasons, the Democrats are soft on communism, the Republican Party is where we need to be. A lot of people thought that way. But the Democrats, I think a lot of times, even myself included, we're inclined to think the Democrats are more or less monolithic. I mean, yes, you get the occasional so-called conservative Democrat, but he's extremely rare. But yet, in recent months, we are definitely seeing something brewing in the Democratic Party, because on the one hand, you have the establishment that really doesn't see anything wrong with a Hillary Clinton-like candidate, a candidate who might have exactly the same views and approach as Hillary Clinton, just be a little bit more likable. And on the other hand, you have insurgents who feel like I might as well vote for Jeb Bush if I'm going to vote for that candidate, and they want to back Bernie. But then the Bernie people, there's a complicated aspect to that because there are a lot of people who think he's not sensitive enough to so-called people of color, and he doesn't use the expression white working class all that much, but we all know that's what he secretly means when he says we need to appeal to them. So I don't know, maybe the Democrats are fragmenting, or is that an illusion?
No, I think it's real, and there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think when you're on one side, it's very easy to see the other side as a group because you hate everything about every aspect of them. But I was talking to a friend of mine who's a prominent Democratic activist during the primaries. I go, help me out. How do you guys think of Hillary? Is it like how the Republicans think of Romney? And her point is, it's much worse. She goes, young college people are one of the main groups that make up the Democratic Party. That's not in dispute. And she goes, if they're voting 80% for Bernie, right? I mean, it was some astronomical number. That will tell you exactly what they think of Hillary Clinton. That's number one. And number two is, this happened in the Republican Party as well. When you have the base, or they can call them the extremists, you could call them the people with principles, whatever, the people who have a very firm point of view. When the base holds their nose and votes for somebody, and then they are not given a victory in return, the whole point of this fairy tale of selling your soul to the devil is, yeah, you sell your soul, but you get to be rich. But in this case, they're selling their soul and they're still losing to Obama twice. So there is an enormous sense of resentment from the base towards McCain, towards Obama. I remember I was at Fox the day that Trump said of McCain, I like the ones who don't get captured. And you would think, you know, within a Republican primary, if you're going to have derision in any sense towards someone in the military, I mean, they'd probably shoot you on sight. It had no negative effect. So I always argue with people, friends of mine, who think the left are a monolith. You have the evangelical left who really, you know, are very have to have their worldview imposed worldwide. Then you have the blue collar people. And so there's very many groups within the left, and they, although they often come together because if the bill is more government, they'll be for it. They do not get along anywhere near as easily as people think.
You're saying in this piece that in every other aspect of our lives, we're totally at peace with and familiar with the process whereby you might, all of a sudden be using Netflix instead of going to Blockbuster Video, or you have many different options. I can watch this, I can watch that, I can do this, I can do that. Whereas in politics, we've had this binary thing. There are two ways to think, and there's winning and losing. And whereas on the market, we vote with our dollar. And even if we lose, even if a lot of people do want to buy stupid things, there's usually still a market for things that we like. But in politics, not so much. But you're saying that in the world today, particularly in the Western world, that's beginning to collapse. We're seeing fragmentation there too. So what you even say at one point is that there is no, I can't remember which of the countries, but you're saying, look, this fragmented political system they now have with all these different approaches and ideologies does not amount to a governing consensus.
I'll get into those. There's a few countries and I want to go through them one by one, but let me talk about something else that you pointed out, which is politics is perverse in this sense. If you look at, you know, Netflix, Hulu, cable, network, TV, there's all these different shows that everyone gets excited about and people talk about on Facebook and social media. Stranger Things is the one people are liking now, which I'm enjoying. And, you know, people hated The OA, which I watched, and Lost was a big one. You know, there's all these shows. The more people, Kimmy Schmidt was the thing for a minute. The more people are excited about these Netflix shows and these HBO shows, you know, Game of Thrones, Showtime, the more these shows percolate, right? The more they're produced and they're like, Lost was great. So now here's four other shows like Lost. Politics during the primaries, the more people get excited, the fewer the choices you get. You go from 17 to one. It's the exact opposite. You would think, okay, we're excited about the political process now. Let's give us 30 candidates to choose from for the general. And it's no. The whole process is weeding people out. It's the exact opposite. And I mean, and therefore you're going to have a lot of people who are disappointed. They're like, hey, I'm into this. Why don't I get to have my guy? Because other people don't like him. That doesn't make sense. Whereas with television, it's increasingly niche, and in food and in every other field. It's increasingly niche. It's increasingly targeted toward the individual. You know, when you and I were kids, if we had these weird hobbies, we were considered freaks and kind of pariahs. I mean, many such cases, right, in high school, junior high school. Now, you go on the internet, you find that one weird guy or girl in another country, and you guys are all into this kind of subculture. And these subcultures, instead of being the focus of derision online and in social media, are something that's valorized and celebrated. So, you know, having this democracy and is basically a landline technology in a cell phone world.
Oh, that's a good one. All right, more great stuff like that after we thank our sponsor. Folks, last year I gave Michael Malice, the guest you're listening to on this very episode, a Harry's shave set as a gift, and he loved it. I refuse to give people knickknacks that are just going to clutter their homes. Here's something practical that he can use that also has a personal touch. I had the shave handle engraved with his initials. Well, this holiday, Harry's is offering custom and limited edition shaving sets that make perfect gifts for the husband, the co-worker, the friend, the brother, the father, any guy in your life. The sets come with German-engineered five-blade cartridges that provide a close, comfortable shave, which is my favorite feature of Harry's. It comes with a foaming shave gel that smells amazing, special limited edition winter chrome and emerald green handles, and personalize it with engraving. Gift sets start at just 10 smackers. Even get something for yourself at Harry's. And as a special offer for fans of this show, we've partnered with Harry's to give you $5 off your order when you go to harrys.com/woods. This offer is only available for the holidays. So this holiday, give Harry's and give handsome. Get your holiday shopping done early and take advantage of free shipping. To get a limited edition holiday shave set while supplies last, go to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. All right, there are a few countries you mentioned by name in your column. One of them is Iceland. Let's start there. Then we'll get to a place like Germany. But let's start with Iceland because people might be less, might not follow the news from Iceland all that closely.
So one of the points you made during our Hamilton debate and that you believe in very strongly is this Jeffersonian idea that if we had 13 states, they would be kind of experiments and each can, you know, go in different ways and look at each other and draw from one another, right? So a lot of times people ask me, what do you care about Iceland? I mean, the population of Iceland is tiny. It's not a world power, to say the least. However, what you find in politics is ideas kind of travel across borders, and certain trends may start in other countries and then carry over here. And Iceland is very, very interesting because if you look at all these countries in Europe, the trends are going from, they used to have, especially right after World War II, you had, let's effectively, the Democrats and the Republicans, right? You had two major parties, broadly left and broadly right. And then you'd have little parties at the wings, maybe this kind of, some kind of, you know, classical liberal party up to the right, and then some kind of post-communist or green party for the far left. But at most, you had two major ones and two fringe ones. Iceland now has gone from that to like 8 or 9 parties in their parliament. And to form a majority, they have to have, last year they had an election, they had to form a coalition between 4 different parties. Even between those 4 parties, they had a 1-seat majority in their parliament, which is not stable at all. And that government lasted for less than a year. Now they just recently had another election. They tried again to have a four-party coalition. And the woman who's the head of the Green Party returned the mandate. She said, even between this, I only have a one-party majority. It's not something that is feasible. So now, you know, the Green Party, which has, there's never been a Green-led government anywhere on Earth, she was in talks with basically their Republicans to form a coalition with another party, still two others, still four. And now, like, all the members of her party resigning in protest because they're like, we're the Greens. We're not going to kind of coalition with the establishment, you know, equivalent of the Republicans. This makes no sense. So it's all becoming increasingly hard. If you can't even get a cabinet together, how the heck are you going to pass any sort of strong, you know, legislation?
We can talk about other countries in just a minute, but doesn't that frustrate people? There are people who really, really do care a lot about politics, and they really, really do want to see what they want done implemented.
Sure.
And if they're just stymied at every turn, is that not a recipe for the strongman who comes in and says, I'm going to stand above all these squabbling groups and rise above the inaction and do something that's best for the people as I see it?
Well, there's two answers for that. First of all, a lot of the frustration will always be the other side. Remember, it's the Republicans who are too intransigent, or it's the Democrats who are too crazy, right? It's never your team. It's always the other team. So that is very, very healthy. And number two, we have seen an example of exactly what you said happening in the Czech Republic. There's this guy whose last name I can't pronounce. He's the second richest man in Czech Republic. He's a billionaire. He's under indictment, you know, or I don't know if he's under indictment, but he's under investigation at the very least. He formed his own party, ANO, in the Czech Republic. They came in first place by far. They had double the amount of seats of the second place party. And what was fascinating is, so his party, he's compared to the Czech as the Czech Trump, but he's far more like the Czech Michael Bloomberg. His platform is all about, let's make government efficient. Let's make it work for everybody. It's not some kind of, you know, blustery, whatever. Second place was the Republicans. Third was the Pirate Party. So the biggest, even in any sense, left-wing party is the Pirate Party in Czech Republic, a party that many of your listeners would have a lot in common with. Fourth are the populists. Fifth were the commies, and the Democrats, the Social Democrats, came in sixth. And historically, they've been a governing party. So this has been a complete upheaval. But here's what's funny. So he has a huge number of seats. He has like 70 seats. He needs 100. No one is coalitioning with him. So even though he is, in a sense, the strongman, not in a Hitler sense, but in this kind of Mike Bloomberg, you know, I'm the guy who doesn't care about politics. I'm going to come in here and clean it up because all these partisans are dope. He can't form a government. Even from the top six, no one's coalitioning with him. This is unprecedented. He's trying to set out to form a minority government, and they're not having it. So again, you have this complete stalemate. Now, is this going to go in a good direction or bad direction? It's certainly in Czech Republic. I have no idea. But in terms of those of us hopeful to bind the hands of government and make politics something that even politicians hate, I think this is a very hopeful step in a good direction. Now, I talked to you a little bit earlier. I would think this is exactly the Rothbardian strategy. Now, I haven't read much of Rothbard, but I would love to hear you expound on that.
Well, certainly he would feel like anybody who's complaining about so-called gridlock is an idiot and instead delighting in it, being thrilled by it. Of course we want this. This is the, if you can't get somebody who's somehow going to repeal everything, the next best thing is they can't get anything done. And this is this may not be the most, elegant way of having that happen. But if they can't get anything done, you got to be happy about that. Now, at the same time, it's true, you may say, if they can't get anything done, that also means they can't repeal anything. But were they really inclined to repeal anything? On balance, when you think about 100 things the government might do in a month, how many of them are going to benefit you? I mean, even if there are two, let's be generous. On the other hand, 98 were prevented. So on balance, we're probably okay. And then you wait until, I mean, I think what's going to happen, I don't know the situation in other countries as well, but I do think that in the U.S., there is eventually going to be some kind of fiscal reckoning because of the entitlements. And then at some point, something does have to happen because it's just reality is going to bump up against it. But until then, probably the best thing we can hope for is that you get a president who can't get anything done. I wonder if the Democrats win, will the Republicans really stop that person from getting anything done? Will that really happen? I mean, Obama did get Obamacare through.
But he and then nothing else for 6 years. And anything he got through was through executive order.
That is true.
They stopped him from the Supreme Court. John Boehner told him, hey, if you do these shenanigans with these immigrants, it's going to be like a red flag. Obama did it anyway, and it was struck down, I believe. But the point is, other than Obamacare, where all these Democrats walked the plank for him, he had nothing to show for it for 6 years that I can even remember. And if he had his druthers, he would have had a lot more done than that. I mean, this is not someone who's content, like, let's say, George H.W. Bush, to be this kind of placeholder president who doesn't rock the boat. He had a lot that if he had his votes, that he would have gotten through. So they very, and also George W. Bush, the last 2 years of his presidency, when Bush was reelected in 2004, he gave a speech in Congress and he said, we should think about privatizing part of Social Security. I've earned political capital and I intend to spend it. And the Democrats openly laughed at him to his face as he gave the speech, and they were right. Absolutely nothing came of it.
Now, one thing I read about, you know, of course, there were a couple of elections recently where the Democrats won, and these people are supposed to be the canaries in the coal mine talking about what's likely to happen to the Republicans in 2018. Apparently, one of the key issues that really hurt the Republicans was health care and the prospect that people feel that one bad health emergency occurs and they're just wiped out. That's all the emergency fund, so-called, that they have.
Right.
So the Republicans, it seems to me, are bound to weaken on health care. So given that there are weak-kneed Republicans on health care because they've seen the numbers, and the Democrats, by and large, want at least Obamacare, if not more.
Sure.
Can't they break through this gridlock to at least bring about more government involvement in health care?
Oh, sure. I mean, we don't have as much political fragmentation here as we can and should. What I am looking at, which I don't think anyone else has registered or not talked about, by far, if you know, Trump is regarded as, they call him literally Hitler. You look at the right-wing Republicans in the House and the left-wing Democrats in the House, and both sides look at the other as complete literal lunatics. By far, the most radical branch of government is the Supreme Court. The fact that Citizens United, which wasn't even the restrictions on political speech, which wasn't even being argued at first during the suit, this was like a 100-year-old decision that was overturned. The fact that that was overturned is really a sign of how far the Supreme Court is sometimes willing to go. And if Trump gets one or two more Supreme Court justices who think in the way that an Alito did, these constitutionalist, originalist kind of things, this is going to have profound and devastating consequences for the state.
All right, let's talk about Germany now, which I think I would know a little bit more about. Most people know more about than we do about, I'm sorry to say, Iceland or the Czech Republic, which are lovely places. But how do you see this manifesting itself there, especially with all the controversy about the migrant issue?
Yeah. So Angela Merkel, and I won't repeat what Berlusconi said about her, but I encourage you all to look it up because it's too foul-mouthed to repeat on this family show. Angela Merkel just got reelected and everyone's like, oh my God, Germany's dead. Germany's dead. Here's how the German parliament works. You have the Republicans and the Democrats ostensibly. Then to the left of the Democrats, you have two left-wing parties. So you have the Greens and you have the Communists, right? So effectively, the voters would be able to fine-tune which kind of leftism you would like. And the same thing on the right. You have Merkel's Republicans, then you have basically the libertarian or classical liberal Free Democrats. And now you have the Alternative for Germany, the quasi-Nazi kind of party. And before people jump down my throat for saying quasi-Nazi, one of the leaders of the party left the party right after the elections because she said, you guys are being way too amenable to post-fascist elements. The point is, ostensibly, that would give the German population the ability to fine-tune what kind of right-wingism they want Merkel to go into. And the Alternative for Germany came in third place with 10% of the vote. Merkel's victory, she lost a huge percentage of the vote. And her victory, even though she's in first place, was the lowest first place victory ever since post-World War II. And now she said, I'm not going to coalition with Alternative for Germany. She can't coalition with the Democrats. She's not coalitioning with the communists. So she's trying to put together a group with herself, the Libertarians, and the Greens. They're calling it the Jamaica Coalition because the three party colors are black, yellow, and green. Now, I can't even imagine what that's going to look like. It's like trying to get, you know, Jill Stein, Rand Paul, and Mitt Romney to form a government. Where are they going to go with this? And this is not through choice. There has never been, since World War II, a three-party coalition government in Germany, and she has no other options. So when you have politicians forced to kind of work together when these groups don't really have anything in common, they're just going to kind of grind their teeth, hopefully, and produce just milquetoast, just rubber stamp legislation.
Yeah, so that really is, I don't know why this didn't, as with so many things in the world, a lot of times things don't really coalesce in my mind until I read something by Michael Malice about them, and then I see it. So people should read your column. And by the way, how often do you publish in The Observer?
It's supposed to be every other week, but I've been so lazy.
Okay, that's what I thought. That's kind of why I was asking.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I'm busy being a talk show host, Tom.
Yeah, that's true. I know it takes a lot out of you, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I mean, one day a week, it's Herculean.
Talk about Your Welcome, your show over on Compound Media.
Oh, my goodness. I had Laura Loomer on Wednesday, yesterday, and that was a hoot and a half. But there's a free episode on YouTube, which you will link to in the show notes page.
I will.
And it's with David Petrezza, who's an amazing political historian, which I really, really enjoy. He's written books about the 1932, 1948, 1968, and 1920 elections, which are all phenomenal and read like novels. And what's great about him is he really shows these politicians to be not very kind people. And just there's no hero worship in them at all, how petty and vindictive and hateful they are. So it's very gossipy in the best sense.
Excellent. All right. Well, what I'll also link to, of course, it'll naturally be linked to because we always link to all previous episodes I've done with a guest. So I actually got to be the first guest on your show.
That's true.
So I'll link to that because I at least have the audio of that people can listen to. But I subscribe to Compound Media, and really the only thing I consume on it is Your Welcome with Michael Malice. That's the only thing. And it's well worth the – how many smackers is it?
I think it's nine. I think it's $9 a month. I don't remember.
Yeah, something like that. It's less than 10. And I mean, to get Michael Malice four times in a month, are you crazy? You tell me you're not going to do this? And to hear him interview – anyway, it's a fantastic show. It is worth – watching. It is worth getting. So we'll link to that. CompoundMedia.com is the website where you can go over there and sign up. And just all you need to do is Michael Malice. Anything else is gravy over there. But Michael Malice's show is what you want.
And by the way, there's a lot of foul language on that network. Let's warn people.
Yeah, that's right. Michael's show is like Mr. Rogers
yes,
compared to the other ones.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Anthony Kumi and Artie Lang have a daily show, and it's very foul mouth, but extremely funny. I'll just tell one joke. They had Chris Hansen on, who was the guy who catches these child predators. To Catch a Predator is his show.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had Artie Lang sitting next to him. And, you know, Chris is very straight-laced, and Artie has the quickest mind like anywhere on earth. And they're talking about September 11th, and Chris Hansen's like, oh, you know, I was in Canada. You know, I wasn't here when it happening. And Artie just goes, oh, were you the Let's Roll guy? And, you know, what Chris Hansen, poor guy, you know, didn't know what to say. And Artie just kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him. It was just amazing to watch.
See, there you go. So I can't say I've watched anything other than your show, though. Yours is the only one I watch over there. But I have reaped many benefits from watching. And the people you have on, it's to me, half the fun is finding out the person you're going to be talking to each week. Which person who's going to make my head explode is it going to be this week? That's half the show to me is, my gosh, you're talking to this person and this person and this person. Really great. Now, of course, if you really want the full Michael Malice experience, yeah, sure, you can watch his show, which I'm telling you, you should do. But you got to be, why are you not following him on Twitter? Like, that's just a definite.
It is. I'm having so
and
much
remember
fun.
In the old days, initially, you were not as much into Twitter. In fact, you even wrote the dear writer is, you know, can more often be found on Facebook than on Twitter.
Right.
But then you realized, hold on a minute. There's a real potential here. So you should be following. It's easy to follow him. He's at Michael Malice. How much easier could that be? MichaelMalice.com is the website. I think that's about all we can say about you if anybody's still listening.
I think that's about all they can stomach.
Yeah, that'll do it. Well, listen, appreciate this talk, and we'll get you on. We've got to get you on again soon. I'm backed up, by the way. I think I've got like 5 episodes of yours I need to watch. And now I think I'm going to go do that while I'm doing other stuff.
Awesome.
Is that allowed?
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. One little note for you before we go. As I am recording this, we are 1 week away from Thanksgiving. And let's just say I'm going to be having a huge deal on the lifetime master membership to my Liberty Classroom website, libertyclassroom.com, on Black Friday. So make sure and check that out. Put that on your Google Calendar and check that out because it's going to be fantastic. You all know about Liberty Classroom. It's where you can get all that propaganda that somehow creeped its way into your brain. You can get it all physically removed and replaced by real live truth. We've got 21 courses over at Liberty Classroom right now. You can listen to on the go anytime you want, 3 o'clock in the morning, doesn't matter. Consume at your leisure. It is the real thing, the real economics, the real history, and other fields as well that you were not taught in school. This is your secret weapon, and I'm having a big, big deal on it on Black Friday. So that is, I think, November 24th, 2017. So make sure and put that on your calendar, your Google Calendar, to remind you. We will be starting it promptly at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time, giving you a huge deal on Black Friday. So definitely check that baby out. If you're afraid you won't remember, then hop onto my email list, because, man, am I going to be reminding people with some highly, if I may say so myself, entertaining emails. Check out tomsfreebooks.com. Get one of those free books, and in the process, you'll be added to the list, and I will let you know about this unbelievable thing that's happening on Black Friday. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.